I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia's Muslim community is rallying behind a student athlete who was benched during a basketball game because she didn't have a waiver to wear a hijab. WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports that lawmakers and school officials are now calling on the state to stop requiring waivers in the first place.
Sophomore Nasiha Thompson King plays for Mastery Shoemaker Charter School in West Philly. Last week, during a quarterfinal playoff game, a referee told the young guard she couldn't play wearing a traditional Muslim headscarf. The reason? The state never cleared it. Mastery principal Sharif El-Mekki is outraged. He says the decision was purely based on prejudice.
Muslim students don't need the PIAA's permission to wear hijab. That's already been provided by God Almighty, and to a much lesser extent, the constitutions of Pennsylvania and the United States of America.
PIAA, the Pennsylvania Interscholastic Athletic Association, requires schools to provide a waiver if a student wears a scarf during competition. Melissa Mertz is Associate Executive Director of the governing body. She says the requirement is there to keep students safe.
We just need to make sure that the student we're putting out there that has a modification, or whatever it may be, that, you know, there's no risk to other students. It's not going to come undone. It's not going to doesn't have any sharp edges, doesn't have any hard unyielding pieces to it, and that everybody's safe.
Fatima Thompson, Nasiha's mom, doesn't buy that.
The hijab does not present any safety issue. It certainly is not woven with any special materials giving the student special powers.
Mertz says PIAA will discuss the policy in the coming months and that it's possible it'll be reworked. In the meantime, her organization has approved a waiver for Nasiha to wear a hijab during Sunday's city championship game. Still, the teenager says it was outrageous that a ref was able to bench her. She's optimistic the state will soon see things the same way.
Change is coming, and it's coming rapidly, and I'm very proud of that.
Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
In the week since the Florida school shooting that claimed 17 lives, Pennsylvania police and school districts are changing how they respond to threats made on social media. For WHYY, Brett Schultes reports that schools have closed and charges have been filed against teens who posted online.
My message to the parents and the kids is the same. Someone out there knows something.
In York County, Central York School District has been closed for 2 days as police seek to learn who posted threatening messages online.
I feel at a loss. I feel sad. I just wish it could be resolved.
Barb Harcourt is a first grade teacher in the district. Harcourt says threats against students have gotten worse in recent years, but she doesn't know what can be done about it.
You know, they can come up with some resolution. I would not want to be them.
In the week since the Florida shooting, there's been a spike in police pressing charges against teens. In West Perry School District, a ninth grader received 34 charges of terroristic threats and 34 charges of harassment for posting a list that threatened students and administrators. In Dauphin County, state police are charging a high school student with terroristic threats for posting on Instagram that he hated everyone at his school and wished they could all just disappear. Pennsylvania State Police spokesman Brent Miller says many of these incidents are playing out on social media.
I don't think there's a particular rhyme or reason to these. I just know with social media and the other forms of communication out there, it seems that there has been somewhat of an increase with threats going on at schools.
What's less clear is what permanent changes may happen when schools reopen and the news cycle moves on.
So many things, and there's so many arguments for gun control or, you know, mental health or parent control, I think it's a combination, you know.
Like many people, Harcourt is willing to try almost anything.
Yeah. To be able to
A lot of people have said, you know, like you could put like metal detectors at the front of schools.
I know.
Is that something that would put your mind at ease at all, or would that feel strange to you?
I think both. I think I'd feel strange, but then walking through, I'd feel safe.
Some people have called for arming teachers.
Oh, my. I'm not for that. There are other teachers that feel differently, but
some advocacy groups have also been pushing for changes. Pennsylvania State Education Association spokesman Whit Keever says his group is pushing for increased security but opposes measures to arm teachers.
Just simply put, teachers' jobs are to teach children. They are not police.
But even for police, the long-term response is uncertain. In the Central York School District, Police Chief Daniel Stump says they don't have a long-term plan.
Well, this experience has definitely led us down a path that we're not familiar with. We're learning as we go as well.
While police and schools seek solutions, high school students around the country are staging protests and walking out of class.
We are not going to have any victories. We are going to have to go through this until we take what victory we can get and build off of it.
At the Pennsylvania School Board Association, spokesman Steve Robinson says maybe that response from the children themselves will be what makes this different from the aftermath of so many other mass shootings.
The student activism is something that I don't think we've experienced with these type of school shootings. I think that their voices are certainly very important in this dialogue, and perhaps that's what's needed to make the changes.
Meanwhile, in Central York, school was closed for a third day Friday, leaving students wondering what will happen next. In Springettsbury Township, York County, I'm Brett Schultes.
And with efforts to prevent another mass shooting dominating the news, let's look at the range of public positions on gun control with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hi, hello, Dave.
Frank, I imagine it's too soon to collect data since that shooting. What do we know about attitudes in general?
Well, 60% of Americans say gun laws should be stricter. That may go up a little more after the kind of event that we saw in Florida, but that's clearly a majority. But it really depends on what type of new strict gun laws you're talking about. Almost 100% of Americans say yes to stronger background checks, something I think President Trump himself came out and said he might endorse. We have 70% who say that things like a 30-day waiting period to buy a gun, yes. Things like registering all guns with police, yes. We get a check off on that. But when we come to banning semi-automatic guns known as assault weapons, and that's exactly how we phrased it, we're down to a little less than a majority, just 48% of Americans who support that.
Though there's been a big jump in the past year or so about attitudes around semi-automatic guns.
That's right. Although it has changed over time, we used to have a majority who supported that idea back in the 90s. And then, as you mentioned, when we go back to 2016, it was down to 36% who supported it. And now, as I just mentioned, when we updated it last fall, that was up to 48%. So that has been a jump, although it's still not as high as it was at some previous time a decade or two ago.
Frank, we've learned that Americans have high confidence in the military, perhaps more than any other institution. Are Americans willing to write a check for more defense spending?
That's a very, very interesting situation when it comes to public opinion, because as you mentioned, the military is the number one institution in America in terms of confidence. A lot of confidence in our institutions has been fading. That's an interesting story in and of itself. But Americans still have a lot of high confidence in the military. When we test something like the ethics and honesty of military officers, they're near the top of the chart. But we do not have a conviction on the part of the average American that we're spending too little on the military. And we do have a majority of Americans who say the military currently is as strong as it needs to be or even stronger. Now, the new budget included $75 billion with the B dollars increase in the military budget, but right now the American public saying, well, I'm not sure that they need that much money or what's it going to be spent for. So I think the president and congressional leaders and military leaders who favor this need to do a better job of explaining to the average American why it is that the military, which they think is doing a great job now, needs so much more money to keep doing its job.
Frank, what country does the public want the military to most closely focus on?
Well, one way we could get at that is to say, what country is the greatest enemy of the United States today? And that right now is North Korea. This has fluctuated a lot over the last decade or two. There was a time when Iraq was the number one enemy of the U.S., according to the American public. Then it was Iran. Then it was China. But this year, we have a huge zoom up in Americans telling us that it is North Korea. In fact, 51% of all Americans say that North Korea is the nation's greatest enemy. Below that is Russia, below that is China, and then Iran. But have I ever mentioned, Dave, that there is a big difference in how people view the world by their partisanship in this country today?
You have, and does that apply in this case as well?
It certainly does. Now, both Democrats and Republicans all name North Korea as the number one enemy, but Russia is where the interesting difference comes through. Only a small percent on a relative basis of Republicans, 9%, opine that Russia is our greatest enemy. But among Democrats, it's 30%, a much, much bigger number. Still behind North Korea, but much, much bigger than Republicans. So that's an interesting difference there in perceptions. Russia looms large as an enemy of this country and about a third of Democrats, but Republicans don't even think of that. They're focused mostly on North Korea.
Is that split much larger than the split for the aforementioned China, Iran, and North Korea?
It is. There are some differences by party in some of these other countries, but the biggest difference is when Americans spontaneously tell us or don't tell us, depending on their party, that Russia is our greatest enemy.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. An important factor in any household is a certain level of financial stability, and usually this responsibility falls to parents. But in this excerpt from WHYY's Common Space, storyteller Emma Hitchcock explains how, at the age of six, she took it on for her family.
I grew up in a tiny podunk town in Vermont. The sort of town where, like, Main Street looks like a Thomas Kincaid painting, and then everything else is just trailers and mud. And I grew up in the everything else section of town with a family that had a very interesting, intricate network of interlocking mental illnesses. So, like, as you can imagine, they had some communication problems. And they started using me as their marriage counselor at a very young age. So, like, by 5 or 6, they would come get me out of bed to mediate their arguments for them. And so I'd be like, Dad, Mom feels that when you go out drinking, it undermines her efforts to make ends meet around the house. Okay. Mom, Dad feels that if you understood his desire to play music more, then maybe he wouldn't drink as much. Most of their arguments were about money. So there was this constant tension in the house of just trying to pay bills and, like, keep food on the table. And despite my parents' best efforts, quite frequently that didn't happen. So in this environment, I became a really anxious child. I was always trying to manage everything. People's feelings and the situation and the future. Like, I would lay awake at night thinking things like, okay, when both of my parents die, how am I going to support my brother and I? My brother was 4 years older than me, but, like, clearly this was my responsibility. So out of all of this, what you got was, at the age of 6, my firm resolution to run away from home. Now, I think most 6-year-olds are probably like, you didn't buy me a Power Ranger. But I was much more like, listen, I get it. I've been looking at the bills, and I really think it just makes sound financial sense for me to leave home and get a job. My reasoning was like, if I left home, we wouldn't be as poor. If we weren't as poor, my family would be happier. Like, it's a bizarrely acute understanding of macroeconomics for a 6-year-old. But that was my decision. So I decided to go where money came from, which, when you're a poor kid from Vermont, is New York. And I was going to get a job. And I knew that would be a little hard because I was a kid, but I was like, I used to climb a lot of trees. I can at least be a gymnast at the circus. Or I can get a job on Sesame Street because, like, I'm a super good reader. So I packed my backpack. And, like, off I go in this Steinbeck moment of, like, go west to New York. So it's about 1.5 miles through Rocky Forest to the main road, which was Route 7, which, just for the record, does in fact lead to New York. And so I'm walking along, and I'm feeling so good about myself. I'm like, I'm going to go to New York, going to get a job. And I was like, I was going to make a ton of money, and then I could come home, and then, like, everybody would be happy, right? But of course, a little while later, my panic-stricken parents drive up in their van. My dad, like, kicks open the door, and he's like, get in the car. And I was like, nuh-uh. And so we have this huge argument. And he's finally just like, why would you want to leave home? And I was like, because I'm too expensive. And I start explaining the whole thing to him in this really earnest way, assuming that he'll be like, oh, you know what? You're right. That makes total sense. Go ahead. But instead, he picks me up, and he throws me in the van. And he turns to me, and he's like, listen, we know you're expensive, but, like, we love you anyway. And I was like, okay, Mom's the rational one. So I turned to Mom, and I'm like, listen, here's the deal. And she's like, but if you left, we wouldn't have you. And I felt so pissed off. Like, I was so angry because I had come up with this elegant solution to a really complex problem, and they were just ignoring me for no reason. And I didn't run away from home because I didn't want them to feel badly. But what I did do was grow up to be a really anxious adult. I still worry about things that aren't really my problem, and I have this amazing talent for being like a, no, seriously, I can fix it, even at my own peril, kind of control freak nature. But that's just who I am, and I honestly feel kind of good about it, because I know that at the very least, in the spirit of self-sacrifice and helping other people, I know that I will be helping my therapist pay his mortgage for years to come.
That's Emma Hitchcock, recorded at a First Person Arts Story Slam for Common Space. It's a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It airs this Sunday evening at 8 on WHYY-FM and via podcast. For some, the flip side of take me out to the ball game is get me home at a reasonable time. Let's look at the clock with Tom Verducci, senior baseball writer at Sports Illustrated, and analyst with MLB Network and Fox Sports. Tom, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Now, some say the sky is falling, but you hold that baseball is doing just fabulously and the game just needs to be tweaked a little bit.
Yeah, the numbers are very good. I think more people consume baseball in more ways than ever before. The tweaks that need to be made to baseball are not a matter of fixing baseball or saving baseball. It's about, I call it updating it, almost like you update your software to make sure that it's compatible going forward. And I think this is more about future than it is about present tense.
Like an anchor, is it that there are more baseball purists than there are in other sports trying to hold it to a standard of long ago?
Yeah, there really are. It's one of the best things about baseball, and sometimes one of the worst things, is that baseball is so hidebound by its past. And now, based on current conversations, the fact that baseball has this charm of not being associated with the clock the way that other sports do. It's very ingrained in the culture of baseball, so it's always been difficult to get baseball to adapt and evolve. It's much easier in the other sports. So the trick is, how do you do that and still maintain that integrity of tradition as the national pastime?
Does Major League Baseball identify the length of games as its biggest problem, as it were, to try to tackle?
Yes, they do. All of their research shows that, as far as the viewing experience especially, that the recipe is not working as far as giving people less action over a longer period of time. Now, they do separate out some of this research in terms of the ballpark experience. They're pretty happy with the ballpark experience between jumbotrons and food choices and all kinds of diversion at the ballpark itself. I think the pace of the game is not nearly as much of an issue as it is as a TV product, especially with the younger generation. And I think that's what's driving Major League Baseball's concern here, is that we're now looking at a generation of fans who maybe aren't becoming hardcore traditional baseball fans, and those casual fans may be leaving the game if the game doesn't hold their attention long enough.
So if it falls down in the TV viewing experience, one might posit that commercials are the primary villain.
There is some truth to that, especially in postseason play where the commercial breaks are about almost 3 minutes long. So there has been some thought about, at least if I'm not shortening the commercial breaks, now there will be a clock so that the players have to be in position to really begin immediately as soon as TV gets back from the break.
The clock and the rule change being implemented for this season, is it of real consequence or just beginning to touch on the issue?
It will help. I think it's a matter of retraining players. The next batter, for instance, has to be on his way to the plate before that clock gets to zero. The pitcher has to have completed his warm-up pitches and be ready to go. It'll make a small difference, not necessarily one a lot of people will notice.
Does that dawdling also in part take the form of more pitching changes than there were before? Once upon a time, a pitcher could pitch 7, 8, even 9 innings. Wow. Now there seems to be midterm and relievers, and how can that be shortened?
Yeah, there's no question that the game that we have today, there are many more pitchers using the course of a game. On average, probably about 6 between the two teams, between 6 and 7. So those are stoppages of play that didn't exist 20, 30 years ago. That's just the way the game has evolved strategically. And there's also more pitches in a major league game now. Because there are so many strikeouts, it takes longer to strike somebody. It takes more pitches. But the biggest difference for me, that in a 10-year period, the time difference between each pitch on average, it's gained almost 3 seconds. And you say, well, that's not really that big of a deal. But when you're talking about 297 pitches on average per game, you're talking about almost 13 minutes that have been added to a major league game where, you know, a batter might take a stroll around the batter's box and the pitcher walks off the mound or the catcher goes out to talk to the pitcher. That's where a lot of this time has been added in the course of the game, just the complete dead time between the pitches.
Who has to be sold on the idea of a pitch clock?
The hardest sell is to the players themselves. Their argument is, you know, we don't need to be rushed along. The game is fine as it is. And one thing the players took exception to when owners brought up the idea of a pitch clock was a penalty associated with it. You violated, say there was a 20-second limit between pitches. If the pitcher violated that, then a ball would be added to the count. If the batter was the one guilty of the infraction of essentially delaying the game, then he would have a strike added to his count. And that was a complete no-fly zone for the players. They fought back immediately, even though they've used that in the minor league. Pitch clock has been around now for about 3 years in the minor leagues. It has shaved time off of games. Players have gotten used to it. In fact, among major league players today, two-thirds of them, 66%, have already played with a pitch clock in the minor league.
Tom, if I ever see you at a Phillies game, count on me for peanuts and Cracker Jack.
Oh, sign me up for that. Absolutely. And we'll sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game in the seventh inning.
Tom, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tom Verducci, senior baseball writer at Sports Illustrated and analyst with MLB Network and Fox Sports. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. At the controls this week, Bob Alls, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.